The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show.
All right. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. I am your guest host today, Courtney Glass, stepping in to interview the one and only Tanya Salsa. We're switching seats today so that all of us, her faithful listeners, can hear her story as an investor and hear about Tanya's journey. Tanya, how are you?
This is a little weird, Courtney. It's like being a guest on my own show. I feel like I should say something else, but I feel like people know who I am already. But yeah, here I am.
They definitely know who you are, which is why many of us are looking forward to hearing about how you got started in real estate and your journey.
So where would you like me to start?
Well, let's go back to the beginning and tell us why did you start looking outside of the Foreign Service? Because as we all know, the Foreign Service can be a very full and a very busy career. So what motivated you to look around into something like real estate investing?
To be honest, I had no idea of ever leaving the Foreign Service. It's an amazing career, as we know. And I went to my first tour, which was in Cote d'Ivoire, and it was a hardship tour with hardship pay, and it was more money than I had seen ever, right? Because it was my very first assignment. And when I came back after serving 2 years there, I was on my way to my consular assignment in Brazil, and I thought, wow, I have so much money in the bank. It was more money than I had ever seen in my life because I didn't spend a lot while I was there, and, you know, I made my own fun and I didn't go out. I didn't travel much. You know, there wasn't a whole bunch to do and the cost of living was very low. And so I managed to save an enormous amount of money. I can't even remember exactly how much it was, but it was enough that when I came back, I was kind of thinking, you know, I should probably buy a house just because, you know, I'll come back here and do a DC tour. And like a lot of people, I thought, well, this seems like a smart idea. So I got a real estate agent. I went around and I looked at a bunch of places. It probably drove my agent nuts, actually, for how many places, because I just didn't know what I was looking at. Like, I didn't know what to buy. I had no idea what I was, you know, seeing. And finally, I don't remember how, like, what number house it was. I found a little small house in Arlington in 2010 or 11, it was.
Okay, I was going to ask what year.
Yeah, it was $325,000 they were asking. It was 2-bedroom, 1-bath, like, maybe 1200 square feet. It was one of those little duplex style, like old, you know, brick kind of things.
Yeah.
And there were tenants living in the property and they said, oh my gosh, we don't want to move. And we're willing to sign a 2-year lease. I said, well, fantastic. Cause I'm going to Brazil for 2 years. Great. And that was how I became a landlord.
All right. Okay. So you buy your first place in the DMV in 2010, which I think we can all agree looking back now, that's a pretty good time to get started in real estate. You go to Brazil, you're a long distance landlord. What's next?
Well, technically I wasn't a long distance landlord because I just got a property manager and they were managing the property for me.
Right.
And I thought, you know, that was kind of fun looking at houses and I still kind of have a little bit of money left, right? Because, and again, I put 20% down on my first house because I didn't realize at the time that like there was less you could put down because nobody ever told me because I didn't know. I was just like, oh, I put down 20%. And I was like, that's a lot of money on a, you know, $325,000 place. It was more money than I had ever seen in my life. And I remember going to the closing table wanting to barf. Like, I was like, I am so uncomfortable. I'm so nervous. And then immediately after it was done, I was like, oh, and they're paying my mortgage. I'm like, oh, that seems kind of cool. So I got the Zillow bug or the, you know, the Redfin bug or whatever you will. And I started looking at houses and I thought, well, maybe I'll just buy another one. So within the next year, I bought another condo in Arlington and I came back and I actually rented it myself and it rented in a week. And I thought, wow, this is really easy. Like I should just do this every tour. That was sort of my idea. And there was no strategy. There was literally nothing more than, oh, I have money. I don't know where to put it. Real estate was kind of fun. And yeah, I guess I'll buy another one as an investment. So I bought a 1-bedroom condo also in Arlington. It was something like, I don't know, $235 or something like that. And then promptly ran out of money because, of course, I was putting down these 20% down payments. And so I was trying to scrape together more down payments to be like, oh, maybe I'll buy a third one. And around 2010, I discovered BiggerPockets. And that was actually when the BiggerPockets podcast came out, right? Yep. And I started listening to these people and they had such amazing stories. I was like, huh, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know people had like 15 houses. I mean, where I grew up, like, people just had one and like, that was it. You didn't even know anybody that had a second house. So for me to have that, even the second property mm-hmm. was like a huge leap. I mean, I tell the story like very simply, but you know, I remember that, like, I think it was like a week before closing. I called my mom. I was like, what if I have no tenants? What if they don't pay? What if I'm stuck with two mortgages and, you know, I have to live under a bridge in a cardboard box? And she was like, really? Like, you're being a little overdramatic here. And my mom called me down, thank God, because that was sort of what launched me into real estate, right?
That's cool. So, okay, so you bought those first two properties. Were you even tracking, like, were they cash flowing? I mean, you said they were covering the rent, like, but that doesn't necessarily mean you were, you know, cash flowing any on those properties.
How were they doing? Okay. I didn't know anything about anything. Like, I was just starting to learn about these things. Yeah. And my Arlington, the first house that I bought, I mean, I think my mortgage was like $1,800 at the time. Seems so low, right? And they were paying $1,400. So I was out of pocket every month, $400. And I didn't care because I was going to live there myself. So it didn't really matter. They were just subsidizing my mortgage and I was paying a little bit of it. Like, no problem, right? And then the second one, I was like, oh, well, the mortgage is X amount and the condo fees are X amount and the rent is exactly all of those things. So technically I'm breaking even. I didn't even know to factor in things like, you know, broken appliances or just sort of deep depreciation and generally. So I really honestly did not know any of that stuff when I started. I had no intention of being an investor even.
Okay. So you started listening to BiggerPockets. Mm-hmm. You got two properties. How do you kind of level up into your next phase?
I got the bug. And people who work in real estate know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, some of the FSOs out there that I know that own multiple properties. It's like you get one, you get a second one. You're like, well, that was kind of easy. Like, I could see. And then you, like, you map out the sort of the projections for 30 years and you're thinking, this would be really great paid off, right? Mm-hmm. And you start to learn more about it, like the tax benefits, you mm-hmm. know, the loan pay down, the appreciation, you know, just all kinds of wonderful things that make real estate the great asset that it is.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, maybe I can buy a third one. And then, of course, you know, I'm at this point a single FSO. I'm not married. I don't have kids. It was me and the dog. That was it. And so I didn't have a lot of expenses, but I mean, I also wasn't getting paid a whole bunch either. Because I think when I got into the service, I was making maybe 50 something like that.
Right.
When I came in. So, you know, short of saving all of my money overseas at Post, I was kind of like, well, you know, there isn't any other way I can make money except to just save it. I didn't know about these other like fancy techniques, right? Mm-hmm. So I started looking around in Maryland because it was cheaper than Virginia. Because Arlington, obviously, I mean, it's a funny place to start, quote unquote, investing, right?
Yes.
Because it's a very funny place, sort of random. But it was the area I knew. So I started that, completely got priced out. I was like, I can't do 20% down payments. Didn't even know about lower down payments. So I started looking in Maryland. I made a bunch of offers in PG County. This was about 2013.
Okay.
And by then the market had started picking up.
Mm-hmm.
So every single property I was offering on, there was multiple offers. And I was cheap and inexperienced. And I was like, well, I just want a low price and this is my price. And my agent's like, this is not very realistic at all. but the poor agent kept writing these terrible offers for me. And I know I was such a difficult client. It's terrible. But now I look back and I think, gosh, what a bonehead I was, right? And honestly, I mean, like, I would lose properties over like $10,000.
Oh.
And I think about it now because I was bidding on townhouses that, you know, were like $150,000 that are now like selling for $350,000. I mean, like, bonehead move, right?
Yep.
But you know, you don't know what you don't know. And that's my agent's telling me, and I'm just like, I think I know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Big mistake. But, you know, you make a lot of mistakes in your investing journey.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how we learn. All right. So you start investing, you spend out to Maryland a little bit. Have you stayed your entire sort of investing career here in the DMV? Because as you were mentioning earlier with Arlington, it's not exactly a beginner's paradise here to try and get going in real estate investing.
No. And especially now, I mean, you think about trying to purchase a little house for $325 is just absolutely bonkers, right?
Yeah.
And So I made a bunch of offers in Maryland and actually didn't get a single thing. I tried for a year and just was unsuccessful. And so I figured I had to change my technique. So I did a lot of research and I followed a lot of things that the people on Bigger Pockets were saying, like, hey, you should research states, like research landlord laws, right? Is it a landlord-friendly state? You know, what are the regulations? Number one thing, economy, are people moving there, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, look at things like the cost of living, you know, the housing prices. And, you know, I settled on Texas because everyone was talking about, well, mm-hmm. Texas is a very great state. Lots of people are moving there, you know, lots of jobs. But I missed a big piece of that, which was property taxes are really high.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in other states that I eventually down the road invested in, you know, you have to worry about things like hurricane insurance mm-hmm. or, you know, just kind of like inclement weather insurance, if you will. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't even thinking about that. All I was thinking of was purchase price of the property, and they were all cheap. Mm-hmm. I settled on San Antonio, mostly because I felt like Houston and Dallas were just so overrun with investors. I wanted something a little off the beaten path, which is kind of funny to say, because San Antonio is a decent sized city, right?
Yeah.
And there were just lots of things I liked about it. It was a really diverse sort of economic landscape. You had universities, you have banking, you have tourism, you have the military. Mm-hmm. So you had a good sector. Like, it wasn't just dependent on one thing. Mm-hmm. So I bought my first little house there. It was like $140,000. Again, seems crazy. And it rented for like $1,350. It was great. It was great. And then that experience went really well. And basically, I just did all my research online. I flew there once. I went around. I was like, okay, that house. And I just bought it. And then I was very comfortable with the neighborhoods at that point. So then when a duplex came up, I said, yep, that one. And so I bought a duplex there too. And then it just sort of snowballed from there. And then I just started looking at deals all over the country. Ended up buying, you know, in different markets, including South Carolina, which if you listen to my episode with Mike Warder, there's that story on there.
Yep.
But yeah, so I dabbled in a lot of other markets, including Texas, South Carolina. I also bought in Florida and eventually moved all my money back to DC.
Yeah, that is super interesting. Were you overseas while you're doing all of this still, or had you come back into any domestic assignments?
Good question. I was actually overseas the entire time from about 2008 when I first started getting the ideas through, let's see, I think I came back 2018, so about 10 years overseas.
Yeah.
So a lot of this was all just research. I would come home at night because I was a little bit obsessed, my husband will tell you. I would sit there with my little computer, like researching markets and looking at all the houses and looking at all the prices and running all my numbers. Because by then, after my first two Arlington places, I was like, there's got to be a faster way to do this. There's got to be a better way to do this. I can't save up $50,000, $60,000 down payments each time. Like, otherwise, I'm going to be an old lady and I'll have five houses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So you're doing all this from overseas. You're doing all your, you know, your research and everything online, very little in-person visiting. Do you have any adventures in property management to share?
Oh.
Since you're buying all over the place and,
you know, actually, I do not have any really bad property management experiences when I was the client. I have bad property management with me as the landlord, but not as the client. Because honestly, I mean, I think a lot of people out there are like, oh, property management, what do they do for me? I pay them and they do nothing.
Right.
And after having managed my own properties, which I have 20 doors now, and it's been over 10 years that I've been managing these properties, I can tell you that having someone else pick up that phone call 24/7, 365 days a year, when there's a really angry tenant or something bad happened, or for example, I'll give you a glamorous landlording story. So I have a property, a 3-unit property in Maryland. And one day I get an email from my tenants and they say, Tanya, the trash people refuse to take the trash. I said, okay, well, what happened? They said, well, we're going to take a picture of the notice on the trash can and send it to you. So basically the trash people refused to pick up the trash can because it had been raining and the lids had been left off and they were full of water. And so they were so heavy, they couldn't lift them. So I was like, well, I told the tenants, couldn't you just dump it out? They're like, we don't really want to. So I drive 45 minutes to go dump the water out. And then I understand why the tenants are asking me to do it. Because the way that these trash cans are positioned, they're kind of right next to the sidewalk. So every single person that walks their dog throws the stuff in the trash can. It was like this cesspool of just nastiness.
Doggy sewer.
Yes. So I had to drag 3 of these gigantic trash cans full of sewage to the street. And of course, you know, I am not dressed for this because I wasn't dressed fancy or anything, but yep. I was not expecting that.
You didn't have a hazmat suit on.
No, I did didn't.
Yeah.
And so that was really fun getting splashed by all that, trying to like spray it down. Like, and you know, every time people are like, oh, I'm going to get all these rental properties, I'm going to be financially free, I'm like, and you're also going to have to do glamorous landlording. So let me tell you a few stories. So there's also the I don't want to say the dark side. It's not really the dark side, but it's like the not so glamorous side of things, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. All right. So how many doors did you get to sort of at your height when you're still, before you moved everything back into the DMV, when you're kind of investing on markets all over the place? Were you more than 20 doors at any point?
No. I was always really small, mostly because just the down payments were tough to swing, right? And I just did everything on my own because I didn't know otherwise. And I've mentioned in other podcasts, like the way to do this faster is to partner with people, obviously.
Yep.
And that's a whole nother story about, you know, who do you trust to partner with? Like, how do you make it so that like it's a good working partnership? Mm-hmm. Stephen Marquette, for example, who we interviewed, he's got some great tips on partnering with other people.
Yeah.
But in terms for me, I just... You know, it was just me, just my computer, just overseas. I didn't have the benefit of going to like any kind of these real estate, you know, investment meetups. And Zoom wasn't as big of a thing then, right? Like pre-pandemic. So it was really hard to get anything except for like talking to people on forums. So, I mean, I think at that point I had the two places in Arlington. I had the two places in Texas. I came back and it was funny because the very first house I bought in Arlington, which I thought I was going to live in, by the time I figured out... When we were coming back, I was like, you know what? That's not going to fit a family in there and the dog who was still with us. And so I said, yeah, two bedroom, one bath is just not going to work. So I went off hunting for a primary residence and managed to do a seller finance deal on a property in North Arlington too.
Okay.
And that, honestly, I found on like MLS, like, you know, basically like Zillow, because in the little comments, it said seller financing available. And I was like, so me, armed with my, you know, 5 years of reading Bigger Pockets blogs, I cheekily wrote to the listing agent, like, I'm a buyer and I want seller financing and here are the terms. And to her credit, she actually took me seriously because honestly, if I had gotten this as a real estate agent, I would have been like, who is this Yahoo? and we did the deal. Like the seller liked the deal. And, you know, he basically held that note for me for 5 years. I actually did put 20% down on that one, but you know, we did like a 30-year amortized loan at 3% interest with a 5-year balloon and 20% down payment. And it worked for him because he wanted to spread out the tax hit over 5 years. He wanted that 20% up front to pay for like his grandson's education. So it was a win-win. And I still own that property today.
That is pretty amazing.
It was cheeky. Yeah. But, you know, knowledge is power. And I have been reading a lot and I thought, well, I mean, the worst that can happen is they say no, right?
Yeah.
And they could have been like, yeah, get yourself an agent and just do this the regular way. And I was like, no. And that listing agent, to her credit, said, oh, well, there's actually a standard Realtor Association contract for seller financing. Here it is. And let's work. Yeah, she was very creative. And so, you know, I owe her that because I didn't know anything about contracts. Didn't know anything at all.
Right. Yeah.
didn't know how I was going to do it.
Was that then the beginning of thinking about becoming an agent yourself?
It's funny you mentioned, because actually that is around the time that I studied and got my license, because I thought, this is kind of fun. I can reach out to agents. I can negotiate these things. And then, of course, I promptly moved to Italy once I got my real estate license. And as luck would have it, you know, I started, people found out that I owned a lot of houses and they just started asking me questions, picking my brain. And, you know, at the embassy cafeteria, you're talking like, oh, you have some houses, right? Like, what about this? And a friend of mine in the Foreign Service, she's like, oh, I was working with an agent, but she's like, I really would rather work with you. And I thought, me? Oh, okay. And so I said, well why not? Right. So I tried. And it sounds funny because literally everything I did, I sort of stumbled into it in a way. Real estate had always been very interesting to me. So I just, the new things, I just kept trying them, you know, and sometimes some were more successful than others and some were kind of like, okay. But at the end of the day, they all worked out.
That's amazing. Okay. So you take on a colleague as a client, as an agent while living in Italy.
Yes.
And found her a property and closed on it and everything from Italy.
Yep. And that involved, some random calls back to the United States. Cause I was like, I really need agents to go show these properties for my friend. And so I had sat in like a realtor class with a couple of agents. So I reached out to them and I said, hey, could you go and tour these properties for some of my clients? And they said, sure. And so, you know, that's kind of how it started. And again, was never supposed to be a real estate agent. Never. I just really got it just to buy and sell my own properties more easily, right? To get in when I wanted to like do research on the MLS, just to kind of do nerdy investor things. And I had such a great experience helping my friend. And then that first year, I think I sold like 6 or 7 homes from Italy because I had a system and people trusted me. Wow. And it worked. Yeah, it worked. It was crazy.
Incredible. That is incredible. Yes. 6 or 7 homes in your first year from abroad.
Yeah.
That's really incredible.
And I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I guess, you know, it kind of speaks to the power of networking too, right?
I was going to say, it is really the testament to the Foreign Service community and the circle of trust that the Foreign Service, you know, kind of just creates, because you're like, well, I know that person, and I know that person is not going to tell me something that, you know, isn't true, right? So,
yeah. Were you the whole time, you know, kind of back to you as investor, were you always just, you know, single family, small multifamily, long-term hold? You never wavered from that strategy. You never tempted to try a BRRRR or a flip or a, you know, any of these really cool acronyms that they have for other strategies.
Well, you know, I think you read all about these things and sometimes they feel like you get shiny object syndrome. You're like, oh, I want to do that. I want to do that. And you can bounce all around if you will. But I think there are certain strategies work better in particular markets than others, right? So like DC is not a market where you can churn through properties really quickly,
right?
Because the selling costs are high and you need to hang on to properties for quite a bit of time before they really start to like get some traction. And then you're really starting to see big gains in appreciation, right? It's kind of a slow burn. And a lot of the DC properties, the first couple of years, they don't really make you money. A lot of times they cost you money, but I'll give you a good example. So that first little house in Arlington that cost me $325,000, where I was paying above the mortgage for, right? Like, my mortgage was higher than what I was getting in rent, right? Like I was paying like $400 above that.
Yep.
That property I sold like 7 or 8 years later to the tenants who were still there. And I sold it for like $465, something like that. So I had a huge gain on that property, right? So like over $100,000 worth of profit I made just from appreciation.
Yep.
And cash flow wise, like I probably just broke even. But you know, that was like a good $100K. Whereas like in Texas, my properties, you know, I bought them for $140,000, $150,000. Maybe I was making $100 to $200 in cash flow a month, which is, you know, $1,200 to $2,400 a year. Mm-hmm. So in 5 years or 7 years, I'm not touching $100K.
Right.
There's nowhere near the returns that DC had.
Right.
And DC, one of the things I really love about it, and when I say DC, I mean the whole DC area, Virginia, Maryland, and DC.
Right.
Is property tax wise, it's a lot lower than a lot of other states. Because for example, in South Carolina, I was paying like 6% in property taxes every year because I did not live in the house.
Yep.
Texas, it was around 3%. Well, in the DC area, the average is kind of around 1 to 1.5%. So yes, the properties are a lot higher, but you're paying a lot less of that in property taxes. So really that means that you get to keep more of your profit, right, off of your rentals.
Right. So what I hear you saying is you bought properties in Texas that met the famous 1% rule.
Mm-hmm.
And your DC properties probably did not even get close to it when you bought them.
Nope.
But in the end, they were more profitable.
They were way more profitable.
Because you held them long enough.
Yes, correct. And I sold them, and the appreciation alone, plus the loan pay down too, right? Mm-hmm. So that particular property, I sold it for like $465. Mm-hmm. And I think I had something like $200K plus that I did a 1031 exchange, and I rolled it into a small multifamily, right, in Maryland. Yep. And that property was a triplex, and it was a cash flowing triplex from day one. So I kind of straddled both I get the cash flow, but then I also get all the benefits of the appreciation. The appreciation, I have to say, in that part of Maryland, which is in Montgomery County, wasn't as great as it is in Arlington, right, for a single family house, but it's still appreciated. So, and I'm getting the cash flow on a monthly basis. So I think it depends on like what kind of investor you are and what strategy you pursue.
No, that's super interesting, especially for me as a long time. I've been intimidated for a long time by the
Markets.
Yeah, expensive markets, because cash flow is so hard to come by. And
it is.
You know, there's a lot of people out there who will say betting on appreciation is a gamble. Mm-hmm. But I think there are some markets where it's really not that much of a gamble. DC probably being one of them, because the basis of the economy is so stable.
And again, you know, I mean, it was $400 above what it was being rented for. So like I could handle that, right? Like I was okay with that. Right. And, you know, I mean, I think if it's like $2,000 over what you're getting for rent, like that's gambling, right? So I think you have to make the mortgage payment work with what the rental amount is. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it used to be that if you put 20% down and you got your property to break even in the DC area, you were doing, you know, pretty well. Now that's really hard to find by just putting 20% down, especially with the interest rates the way they are.
Right. Speaking of interest rates, what are you seeing, just for, you know, any listeners out there who are looking to buy still now in the DC area? I'm hearing a lot of chatter elsewhere about, you know, the market is softening. You're seeing some price drops in listings. Definitely not crash or any of those kind of words, but softening, I think, is what I hear most often. How does that affect the DC area? Does it affect the DC area?
I think, you know, things that are priced well still go in a weekend, maybe not, or 2 weekends maybe. And it's always about the price, right? And so the fact that the interest rates went up as fast as they did, and increased as high as they did, really ate away at people's purchasing power. So what I'm telling people when they're evaluating whether to rent or buy, for example, in the DC area, like we look at the numbers and, you know, if they say, well, our budget is $3,000 a month, right? This is where we want to live. This is what kind of the, you know, the space that we need. Then we look at, okay, does it make sense to spend 20% down? What is the mortgage? If the mortgage is going to be $3,500, right? But you are getting an actual house that you were going to keep, and you're going to keep coming back to when you come back to the DC area over the next 10, you know, 12, 15 years, might make more sense to buy. Because again, the interest rates, they go up, they go down, they mm-hmm. go all around, you know? So, you know, if you lock in at the current interest rates and then the monthly number still makes sense to you, right? So yeah, okay, you'd like to spend $3,000, but you can spend $3,500, let's just say, right? If that makes sense to you, you can afford it, and you're happy with what that buys you, and you're going to keep the property for a long time, then I think you just have to go back to the numbers to make sense. Because, for example, like let's say you know you're going to be here for 3 years at that $3,000 number. I mean, that's basically $36,000 a year you're spending in rent that you cannot get back, right? Where you're paying down your mortgage, you're getting the tax benefits. And then, you know, once you leave in 3 years, somebody else is paying that mm-hmm. for you. Yeah. So then it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense if you're really only going to be here for 3 years and maybe you're retiring and you're moving to Hawaii or something.
Right.
Then it doesn't make sense, right? So I think we always try to look at, for the person's situation, are they going to be here long-term? Mm-hmm. Are they going to use it? So for example, we had a couple with a baby reach out, and they're like, we really want to live in Clarendon in a 2-bedroom condo. Should we buy one? And we looked at the numbers and I was like, I wouldn't do it, because your mortgage is going to be $1,500 more than renting. And you told me that you want to have more than one child. Yep. You're never going to live in this place again. Like yep. never. And it's yep. not a good rental. It just isn't a good rental. There's other things that are going to be a better rental. So that's kind of how we evaluate it.
Yeah. Which I can understand then why you have FS clients flocking to work with you guys, because I think that's a hard, it's a hard calculus for a lot of people who aren't familiar with the FS community to make and to steer people through.
It is. We really try to get people to think a little bit longer term and think about how they might want to use the property, not just for this assignment,
yep.
but like their second or third time they're coming back to DC, right? I think that's really sort of the kicker, because anybody could just go out and buy a house. All FSOs, I have not met one yet who the bank is like, oh, sorry, not qualified.
Right.
So that isn't a problem for people. The question is, what are you comfortable affording? And does that match with what the market is offering, right? So for example, you know, you can probably go buy a townhouse, but if you have like a $4,500 mortgage payment when you can just rent it for $2,900, I mean, it just doesn't really make a lot of sense. But I will say too that, you know, everybody likes the 30-year fixed. There's a lot of great adjustable rate mortgage products that will get your rate down back into the fours. And a lot of people, if if they don't plan on living in the house forever, if they're going to be there in at least, 7 years, I would say, then it may probably make sense to buy and then sell it before you, maybe go overseas, again, if you're staying in DC, like let's say for 8 years or something like that. So
it's funny that you bring up the adjustable rate mortgage, because I just finished reading Sam Dogan's, this Financial Samurai's new book, and he strongly advocates for that in his book, because he says, the average amount of time Americans live in their homes now is shorter than ever. And so in fact, that is probably in many people's cases, the best financing option, which is very counter to what you almost always hear.
Exactly. And I think it's worth challenging the idea of the 30-year fix, because honestly, although it seems cheap, it actually is the most expensive rate now.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of people, especially, for example, if you're, just starting the foreign service, it's just you, maybe you don't have, kids or pets or whatever it is, and you're buying a one bedroom condo, adjustable rate mortgage might be for you, because you may want to live in it for 2 or 3 years, leave, rent it out for, five, and then see kind of what the, rates are doing. And then either you can sell at that time and you can probably recoup everything that you put in there, maybe some more, given what the market is doing. But in the meantime, you aren't paying like 6.5%. You're paying, 4.5, right?
Yep.
Saving hundreds of dollars every month on your mortgage.
Yep. No, that's a great point. So returning a little bit to sort of your story, you invested out of state, you did sort of the long distance investor thing. And now you're all in, back in the DMV. Was it just watching your properties appreciate here that convinced you that this was the strategy for you? You're a buy and hold, and you're going to do it in this market from now on.
Well, I never had any intentions of leaving the Foreign Service. I figured it was going to be my, career until retirement. And that was what I was planning on. I never planned on doing any of this, really. And honestly, Bigger Pockets gave me the bug. Real estate gave me the bug. Reading about how other people had kind of organized their real estate portfolios in order to be financially free was extremely attractive to me. And I got to a point in my career where I had done what I wanted in the Foreign Service, because I stayed almost 13 years, I think. And I just didn't see myself, staying in for another 10 years. I had done sort of the things that, I joined for. And, I think there comes a point, especially kind of in the mid-level, where you're kind of in the middle of the sandwich, right? You're not like bright and bushy-tailed entry level, like, yes, I'm going to do all these things and it's so exciting and it's great and look at all these tours. And after like your fifth or sixth move, you're like, oh my God, I don't think I can do another PCS. I'm going to die. And then you have all those boxes in your closet. You're like, oh my God, I have not opened those boxes since like two tours ago. And I don't even have the energy to open them. So I just got to the point where like moving again, and it was honestly, it got to be like a mental health issue for me. Like, I cannot do this anymore. And then there's so much strain on like relationships. And, we met so many wonderful people at Post, and then we would see them like for a year and then they'd be gone. I'm like, well, I would like a friend that like, stays around for longer than like half a tour. And then I only see them once every 3 years, that just got to be really hard for me. So we decided that we would come back and just root ourselves for at least 5 years. So that's the plan.
Okay. So you're back here. You got your 20 doors. You have now transitioned out of the Foreign Service, and you are a full-time agent running her own team.
Yeah. How does that happen? Right. Well, and here's the thing I think that's important for people. So I have 9 mortgage loans, okay, for these 20 doors, because a lot of them are small multifamily, right? I've got 3 triplexes and 1 quad, right? And then I've got a smattering of condos, 1 townhouse, and a couple single family. So I've got a mix in my portfolio. Mm-hmm. I did almost all of those loans just in my name on my State Department salary. It was not with anything else. Yep. And the reason is because the rent that was coming in more than covered the mortgage payment, right? Normally they use, I think it's 75% of the rent to determine whether that can cover. So it basically zeroed itself out. Mm-hmm. So people are always like, how can you do that? And I'll tell you, it is possible on one person's salary if you crunch the numbers correctly. And it is possible to stack your portfolio, right? This is going to sound kind of funny, but I think I applied for a commercial lease because I am opening an office in Northern Virginia and actually renting commercial space. And so they sent me one of these tenant forms to fill out. And I was like, oh, this is going to be interesting. You know, they do the credit check and they do all this stuff. And comes back. And I think I have like $2.8 million worth of mortgage debt, which I was like, oh, I actually thought it was more. I know it sounds really funny to say, right? And some people just hearing that number, I think it might give them a heart attack. Yeah. They're like, what on earth?
Yeah.
But you think about it, like I've got more than 20% equity in almost all those properties because investment property, don't forget, at a certain point, they want you to put 25% down. So y'all can do the math, right?
Yep.
I don't mind sharing. And honestly, if every single one of those properties was paid off fully right now, it'd probably be like over $5 million worth of real estate, probably $5 or $6 million worth of real estate. And guess what? It will be paid off one day. And I will still be old enough, or maybe not old enough, young enough, sorry, to enjoy fully paid off properties, which maybe I might do, maybe I might not, right? But So I think at a certain point, like all of those properties, the profit that they were bringing in gave me sort of the reassurance that I could leave the department and just do real estate because I enjoyed it. I really liked it. I liked helping, you know, foreign service people. And people would ask, like, how'd you do it? How can I do it too? So I wanted to really help people to understand kind of how I did it because honestly, I was not very systematic. I did not have a plan. I stumbled around. I tried a bunch of different things. I could have done it a lot faster. Matt Spaulding, looking at you because you are like the man, like so organized in 1 year. That's how I would have done it if I had known any better. But I didn't. I like just bungled around for 10 years and still it came out okay. Because, you know, the Foreign Service is a great career for a number of reasons, but also because it gives you this platform that you can take a little more risk than the average person who's worried about being laid off. You have abilities to really bankroll large down payments for real estate, which the average person does not.
Right.
So there's a lot of gifts that come with this career that people can use. And so if I can share my experience and people can get something from that or it inspires them to go and do it, I mean, that's really the goal of, you know, what the work that I do as an agent and also why the podcast exists.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And I think a lot of people are going to be thrilled to finally get this chance to hear your story, hear your evolution. And I mean, what you're saying about leverage. Yeah, you're right. I think I can think of many people I know who are colleagues in the Foreign Service who would hear that $2.8 million in debt and just, you know.
Oh, people would fall over dead. I would have fallen over dead. Yeah. I mean, I thought buying a $325,000 property was the most terrible thing I had ever done.
Yeah.
I will say it gets easier. So writing those big checks, I mean, and I feel for clients because they're sending large sums of money by wire from like Africa. Yeah. And they're like, it's fake money. All of a sudden they just pulled all this stuff out of my bank account. Like, where did it go? Right. It's very scary. It's still scary.
Yeah.
But the more you do it, the better you get at it, the easier it gets. And if you follow basic fundamentals, it actually isn't that scary. And the more you read about, the more you learn. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's like rental real estate, investment real estate is not rocket science. You do not need, you know, really complicated math. I am not a complicated person. Like I can see real estate. I can touch it. I can poke it. It makes sense to me. Like I can look at neighborhoods. I understand why one house is better than the other. You asked me about crypto. I don't know. Stocks, not my thing. Real estate, I get. I can see it. It makes sense to me.
Well, and what you're saying about leverage is one of the key advantages of real estate, right? You can't take that kind of leverage and that favorable kind of, you know, debt terms and buy stocks with that.
No.
Margin loans are nearly that generous as getting, you know, residential loans or whatever. That's why it's a great asset class and why I think most personal finance gurus will recommend having at least a certain percentage of your assets allocated into real estate.
And I always look at land too. Like in DC, I really love because the land is fixed. They aren't making any more of it. They can't make any more of it. The only way that they can go is build up, which they try to do. But even then, the population has been growing. It continues to grow. There's jobs continuing to come here. And they're just, I mean, the rate at least, you know, that DC is going in terms of economics, right? And jobs and the people that want to move here, it's just increasing. The land is not. So for me, DC as a long-term play makes a lot of sense.
It's a supply-demand issue, yeah.
Correct.
What about, on that note, effects of the pandemic on the real estate landscape here? Obviously, I think a large percentage of the DC economy is based in knowledge jobs or knowledge workers, many of whom now have a lot more options to work remotely, or at least hybrid. Mm-hmm. Is that changing, you know, hot neighborhoods or areas or suburbs in a way maybe you haven't seen before?
Yes and no. So early on in the pandemic, once, you know, I would say probably early 2021, people started to be like, oh my God, I have been in this house with all these people I live with, and we're on top of each other and we need bigger space.
Right.
And that's why I think you saw this explosion in 2021 and also the beginning of 2022 of people moving out and just larger square footage, right?
That was nationwide. That was happening in cities everywhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Across the nation. It was people wanted more space. Like, you know, we're on top of each other. We're all teleworking. Yeah. So I think demand changed, right? People also moved out of the area and out of like core city centers.
Right.
And I mean, condos just took a hit, I think, in most places, 2020, 2021 especially, right? Mm-hmm. And the condo market, honestly, is not soft anymore because of COVID. It's actually coming back and it's pretty stable. And honestly, like there's still not a whole lot out there, right? So while condos took a, I don't want to say a dive because they didn't really, they were just kind of like the person nobody wanted to dance with at the at the club, right? They're just kind of like, I'm here, okay, what's going on?
Yeah.
Well, houses were like, all people were so like, oh my God, I want a four bedroom. I was like, but four bedrooms are like the most popular thing ever right now. And they're all like blowing past a million right now. And what? Like this year was insane. Yeah. Like the prices just went bonkers at the beginning of the year. So, but all that's to say, demand changed a bit, but at the end of the day, DC is still DC and there are people that want to live a city life and they like being in the city. They like being close to work. They like all of the things. None of that has changed, right? Mm-hmm. So even with federal workers, I had people who moved kind of far out and after a year they were like, this is too far. And I'm like, wait, what? What? What do you mean? And they, you know, people out in like Burke, Virginia, for example, they're like, I cannot commute. Like this is too long. And they're calling us back. And even though I have to go 2 days a week now, like I don't want to do it. So they turned their, you know, townhouse into a rental and they moved to Arlington. Mm. So, you know, there's lots of dynamics at play. Yeah.
Yeah. That's very interesting. All right. So you've got this great, real estate team going now, you know, Foreign Service clients make up a big part of your client base. I think we'll just give a teaser to everybody and say we are going to have a follow-on episode where we talk about what's next with Tanya and growing her business in additional ways that are going to help serve her Foreign Service client base. So tune back in to find out what's next for Tanya.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.